This is Everett Hawkins, K, and it is November 3rd, 1983, and I am Joanne Lampman. Okay, I wondered if you'd just start out and tell me about your background, where you were born, and your educational and social background, and so on.
Well, as you know, I was a Canadian. I was born in a place called Orillia, Ontario, which is north of Toronto.
Not necessarily. Your parents were.
I was just trying to think that my father was a civil engineer at the time that I was born. He was a city engineer of Orillia and was in charge of building a large dam at the Ragged Rapids for munitions manufacture, this of course being during World War I. He died in 1918 in the flu epidemic, and so my mother and my younger brother and I moved back to Toronto to live for a while with my mother's mother, my Edda's grandmother. We stayed there for a few months, and then my father's mother, my Greenwood grandmother, invited us to come and live with her in Vancouver. So at a very young age, my eldest brother at that time was already in boarding school at Ridley College in the Niagara Peninsula, a place called St. Catharines. And so we left him, my uncles agreed to take care of him, and we moved out to Vancouver, and I became a British Columbia girl. I've always told everybody I came from B.C. without going into all the details, because I really did grow up in Vancouver. I went to Crofton House, which is a private school, for a great many years.
How many children were there?
There were actually four of us. My elder sister, I never knew, she died at age 4 months before I was born. My eldest brother is no longer living. He died in 1977. My younger brother is still alive. He was an official at the United Nations all his working career after the end of World War II. He retired a year or so ago, and he's now living in Florida with his American wife. So anyway, my mother and my younger brother and I moved to Vancouver. How much do you want to know of those earlier years?
I want to know what your mother did, for instance.
Mother was a pianist. She was a product of the Toronto Conservatory of Music. And back in the early 20s, a girl who had all kinds of education but no career training couldn't do very many things. She couldn't teach music because she had married my father 6 weeks before taking her final exams at the Toronto Conservatory. And my grandmother said, "Well, it doesn't matter, dear, you're getting married." Mother had no diplomas, and she could, teach music. So what did she do? She did the only thing that she knew how to do was to make a home. So she rented a great big house out near the university and took in university students.
You never heard her express any resentment or anything about having to give up?
Oh, of course she did.
She expressed it?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. She felt very unhappy about this because it meant that she couldn't, back in the 20s, pursue a career.
And your father wouldn't have encouraged that?
I don't know about my father. I was only 5 when my father died. Back in those days, it would be extraordinarily unusual for a woman.
And I suppose it was too late for him to go back.
Well, it was really too late. My father was only 37 when he died. He left her very hard up. He didn't have any insurance. People didn't think in those terms in those days. And so mother was left very hard up. Granny Greenwood kept us with her for several years, but mother had a great urge for her own independence. She felt that she had to do something.
Yeah.
And so, as I say, the only thing she knew how to do was to make a home. And she, so she, I've often thought, the students who stayed with her, she did it for about 3 years, the students who stayed with her were just incredibly lucky because she did everything for them, you know. And on Sunday afternoons, she would serve tea and cakes beside the fire in the living room, and they could bring their girlfriends, and she would play the piano for them, and they all just thought this was wonderful. And it was, when you think about it. And one of those students became my stepfather.
Oh, really?
A Swiss civil engineer. He was an electrical engineer. Mother had a weakness for engineers. He was finishing his engineering studies at the University of British Columbia. He was a violinist, and when Mother suddenly realized that Mother was a very fine pianist, this was just, you know, a wonderful thing. And he used to play his violin and she would play the piano for the other students and their girlfriends. And it was a great thing, it really was. And I grew up, this was my sort of beginning to listening to classical music right from the start, practically. And so he proposed to Mother 14 times on the record. She said, "I'm too old for you, don't be ridiculous."
Was she allowed to?
14 years.
Oh, 14 years.
14 years, and he proposed to her, I think, 14 times.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so finally she agreed, and they were married, and of course she stopped doing what she was doing.
Now, how old were you with that?
I was 10.
You were 10?
I was 10 when I acquired this very nice stepfather who became like a big brother. And he was the one who encouraged me to paint.
Was he a good father also, as well as like a brother?
Oh, yes. But you see, I was already 14, so I didn't need, the kind of my needs were different. I mean, I left home not too long after that.
Well, why do you suppose he was the one that encouraged you?
Well, the reason for that was because I remember very vividly, when listening to him practice his violin, I said, "Oh, it would be so wonderful to be able to do that." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, okay, we'll give it a try." And he let me try, and after a few desperate efforts, he said, "You know, Kay, you just don't have an ear for music." He having perfect pitch.
Hard on somebody else.
It's hard on anybody else. His standards are very high. And after a few weeks, he realized that I had been very crushed by this, and he said, "You know, I think you could draw and paint." And because he had had the kind of drawing training that an engineer gets, he could do beautiful drafts and things, just beautiful.
Well, had you picked up pen and pencil, or?
You see, at school, I went to a private school, and we had very fine art classes. And so he could have seen the kind of work I brought home and things like that.
Well, now, why did you know somebody from private school?
My grandmother, Granny Greenwood financed my going to private school.
So public schools weren't acceptable?
Public schools were perfectly all right, but Granny felt that we came from our family were landed gentry, and while we were hard up, we were considered that we had to try to maintain certain standards, which is ridiculous in Western Canada. But Granny was old enough, and her memory reached far enough back into the past that she was trying. Well, poor Kay, after all, she has to be a lady. And so I was sent to this very, very exclusive, very expensive private school in order to not lose the opportunity of continuing to be a lady. and which was ridiculous. But anyway, you know, it was a good experience for me. And I had benefits like early training in French and a good training in art and all sorts of other things like that that I wouldn't have had at the public school in Vancouver in those days.
What was being a lady meant to make it attractive to find a husband?
Oh, sure, to find a husband. She assumed that the day would come when I would be a debutante in Toronto or Vancouver or somewhere, and I would go through the whole social bit.
And did you think about that?
Well, no, of course I didn't.
That was just normal.
I never had that because when Mother married my nice stepfather, Otto Niederman is his name, he's still alive, he accepted a job up in northern British Columbia when I was about 13, I guess, 12 or 13, somewhere around there, as the assay officer of an American mining company that was operating up north of Prince Rupert in those days. And there was absolutely no control over how mining was carried on. And
no regulations.
No regulations at all. The mine was at one place and the smelter was down near the beach where the ships came in, because the only way to get there was by ship. The fumes from the smelter, it was a copper mine, so it was arsenic in the fumes. And everybody who worked there came down with arsenic poisoning and worse. You know, it's totally uncontrolled. I'm talking about the 20s.
Yeah.
And so we stuck it out for a year because he'd signed a contract. And then we came back to Vancouver. And so because of that, Otto said, well, Kay's going to have to earn her own living. It's very nice for her to know how to behave, but she's going to have to earn her own living. And it's ridiculous for her to go on at private school. And so when we came back to Vancouver, then I went to the high school.
Your mother concurred.
Oh yeah,
your
mother grandmother had died by this time,
uh-huh.
And she had left us all some money in trust.
Would she have objected? Had she been alive?
Granny would have been terribly upset.
Oh yeah,
she would have been terribly upset. You know, she was the last link with a whole world that I.
Different world.
You know, just yeah. Well, it doesn't exist anymore for one thing, Granny was trying to maintain standards which she didn't realize were already responsible. Well, not standards, but ways of achieving them.
Yeah.
So that this is different. So, anyway.
You went to public high school.
So I went to the high school.
This was in Vancouver.
We were living out near the university. Vancouver is so beautiful, as you know, with those views over the mountains and the gulf and so on. I got a scholarship to go to the university, and so I did.
The University
of British Columbia. I majored in Latin with Greek as a minor and French with German as a minor, which was a terribly lopsided thing to do, and I've regretted it all my life because I have wished that I had other things to add to it.
Were there no advisors in those days?
We didn't have advisors in those days. And I discovered when I was signing up for my program that if I did a combined honors course, I wouldn't have to write a thesis. I thought that was wonderful.
So you did languages which came easily, obviously, for you.
I did languages which came easily. I had to work, don't think I didn't, because of the scholarship. I had it for the 4 years, but I had to maintain first-class honors standing. And so that required keeping the nose to the grindstone.
Well, looking back, what would you have taken?
Oh, I would have taken more history and economics and more current affairs.
Mm-hmm.
I think I wish I had trained for something that would have provided today women have so many opportunities to pursue careers as such. I don't mean just jobs, but careers.
Yeah.
And at that time, there really wasn't very much for a woman. What I wanted to be all the time I was going through college and what my plans were to be, just about the time I was in my junior year, an American woman by the name of Mrs. Ruth Bryan Owen was the first American woman ambassador, a minister in those days, the first American woman minister appointed to Copenhagen. I still have the clipping announcing her appointment. I said, if an American woman can do it, so can I.
Well, good for you.
And so I decided that what I was going to be when I got through everything else was to be a lady diplomat. This was my intention, this was my ambition. Growing up there in Vancouver, watching the ships coming and going from around the world.
This was when you were younger than in college, you said?
No,
this is during college.
This is during college. I wanted to be a lady diplomat and see the world. I was going to get on those ships and sail away.
Well, it seems like I'm learning. Prepare yourself with the languages in it.
Oh, yes. The languages were certainly part of it.
Were there
I wasn't living at home. The year I started at university, Otto and mother moved up the trail, which is in the interior part of British Columbia. Otto joined the Consolidated Mining and Smelting Company, which is an enormous operation. It's the largest thing of its kind in the British Commonwealth. The Consolidated is an enormous mining organization with activities all over the world, not just but the headquarters in British Columbia. And so they moved the trail to it. Take a position there.
Was he sort of a senior engineer by this time?
Not at first, but he worked out. Actually, at first, he was in charge of the training the apprentice program. Mm-hmm. He turned out to be a very good teacher. They discovered he was an excellent teacher.
He must have been 45 or so by then.
Hard to think. I suppose he was, yes, he must have been. No, he couldn't have been. No, he was younger than that. He was still in his 30s.
Well, he was doing well in
the family. He was still in his 30s. You see, he and mother never had any children, and I was already more or less off on my own. You see, I was 16 when I started college, and they went up the trail. I stayed on and I became an out-of-town girl at the university, which was a funny sort of experience. But I thought I was a Vancouver girl, and I used to get listed as an out-of-town girl and all sorts of university social things.
Yeah.
A poor outsider. Well, that was all right.
That sounds to me like your family, after your mother married, was a well-to-do family. How old was you around?
Oh, well, Otto wasn't wealthy. He's not to this day.
Ah.
He never became what you would call
wealthy.
Because
he was in that big business.
Heavens no. The Consolidated is a huge organization, but I think only Mr. Glaylock, who was the general manager at that time, I think he was who made any. Well, people weren't well paid in Western Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
of course, those were depression type years.
These were depression years. The depression was a very difficult time.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very hard up there for quite a while.
Well, so you graduated.
So I graduated from UBC. And then I
graduated. What year was this?
1933. I graduated with first class honors. I remember getting a letter from the Minister of Education wanting to know if I was going to pursue a classical scholar's studies, because I had done so brilliantly, it's quote unquote,
mm-hmm.
in the exams, and I had no desire in the world to teach Latin.
Mm-hmm.
I was not going to go on to pursue classical studies, and several people who were interested in my career were very disappointed by this. And here I'd already made up my mind I was going to be a lady diplomat, so what to do?
How were you going to?
Well,
implement that.
There was no Royal Road in 1933 in Vancouver, or even anywhere in Canada. There was no Royal Road. The Canadian External Affairs Service was a very small affair. It was just beginning. It first started in 1912, but was very modest for a long time, because until 1931, I think it was, Canada didn't even control its own foreign policy. You know, in 1931, the Treaty of Westminster created the dominions as self-governing entities. But again, it was depression time, and so there was not a great deal done at that time about setting up missions around the world, because they couldn't afford it. At that time, we had a high commissioner in London, a minister in Paris, a minister in Washington, a minister in Tokyo,
And
that was it. Of course, they were all men.
Uh-huh.
There was no thought of women.
Well, that did.
Absolutely no thought of women. This was a very wild idea that I had.
Yeah.
A very wild idea.
A dream.
And so, did I say that we had a minister in Tokyo?
Yes.
So I thought, well, I'd better take a business course. That might be useful. So I had an aunt and uncle living in New York, Captain and Mrs. Henry McConkie. Uncle Harry was the Marine Superintendent in New York for the Cunard Line. And they had lived long years in England and in Germany and various places with the Cunard. And Aunt Eleanor had gone to school with a friend in Vancouver, whose father had been agent general for BC in London and various interesting things. And she had a great big old house in Vancouver, about two doors from where my grandmother's house had been. My grandmother's house had long since been demolished, and huge modern buildings had gone in there. It's now down in the business section. She arranged for me to stay with Marjorie Wade, and Marjorie Wade's house was absolutely fascinating because she had paying guests. She had been divorced, and that was unusual in those days. And she was working for the Harbor Board. And she had a journalist and a woman whose husband had been the representative for Macmillan, the publishing company in China, and a very interesting woman from Scotland and her daughter. Her daughter is still a close friend. And another Englishman, who was termed scornfully in those days a remittance man. Do you know what a remittance man is? These are the younger sons of English families whom the family decided they're never going to amount to anything, and they paid them to go away and disappear.
Oh my.
There used to be lots of remittance men in the British in the British dominions. You know, sons who didn't seem to be able to really amount to anything.
Oh, my.
And they didn't want them hanging around the ancestral home in England, and so they would send them off to seek their fortunes in different parts of the world, and they would send them a small amount of money each month to live on, and we'd never want to hear from you again. And so one of these men, a chaplain named Harold Forrester, who was a marvelous person, great fun, he'd been all over the world, terribly interesting. All these people have been all over the world, and of course this was wonderful for me, I just lapped it up. He did the cooking, Harold used to do the cooking for us when he was sober. And it was great fun, it was an enormously interesting house. So I spent several months with that establishment. Someday I'll write a book about them. And. While I was there, I went to a lecture one evening at the university, a chap by the name of Alfred Zimmern, Dr. Alfred Zimmern, who was lecturing about the Zimmern Institute in Geneva, Switzerland. And I suddenly realized that this was what I was looking for. I thought, well, I knew about the League of Nations, I was well aware of the existence of the League of Nations, and I thought, well, this might be some way into an international diplomatic kind of thing, but how to do it? Well, Marjorie, knowing everybody in Vancouver, was able to find out where the Zimmerns were staying. They were staying with General Odlum, who was an old friend of Marjorie's. She called the Odlums and they'd say, well, they left for Victoria this morning, but they're coming, this was Saturday, but they're coming back on Monday and will be here for a couple of hours Monday morning. If you want to tell Kathleen to come out to the house, we will see whether the Zimmerns would have time to just speak to her. So I did, and I was interviewed by Mrs. Zimmern for about half an hour, and the longer the time went on, the more encouraged I got. And at the end of about a little more than that, she suddenly took me in to see her husband. I had passed some kind of test. And so I had a chat with them, and they told me about this school and what they did. And I said, oh, how wonderful it would be to be able to go there. Well, they made no commitment of any sort. I said I would try terribly hard to see if I couldn't get there somewhere for that summer. And they departed, and I finished my business course. And I decided, well, I still had a little money left in my grandmother's trust fund. And so I bought a ticket from San Francisco, round the Panama Canal to New York, and then as far as Paris. There wasn't enough money to get a ticket any further than Paris.
Tough.
No, I was trying to get to Geneva.
Yeah.
But that's what I did, and I had a little extra money. And so not too long after that, I set forth. I didn't leave Vancouver on a White Empress ship. I left on the ferry to Victoria with a couple of my friends and then my younger brother who came to see me off. And then I took the ferry down to Seattle. And then a friend of mine from college days joined me, and we went by bus down to San Francisco. And there Jessie departed. She's still a friend. She lives up in the Okanagan part of British Columbia, and I see her now again.
Tell me, before you go on, had you finished a business course then?
I never really finished it.
Would you have a year?
No, I didn't even. I had about 7 months.
I see.
I never really finished it. If I'd really had to get a job on the strength of my business course training, I never would have got the job. Because that really wasn't what I wanted to do. I just thought it would be useful. I just thought it would be useful. So I set off, went around the Panama, which was a marvelous experience. Was met by my uncle and aunt in New York. And Uncle Harry had business in Washington a few days later, so we drove down to Washington the first time I saw Washington, back in 1934. Excuse me. And then Aunt Eleanor and I drove up to Toronto to see my other grandmother, whom I hadn't seen, of course, for all those years, and my eldest brother, whom I'd only seen once since we were small children. He came up once in Vancouver, and various other cousins and people. And a letter arrived, forwarded to me, from the Zimmerns, which had been following me around all over the place, saying that they were offering me a scholarship to come to their summer institute. I was to be the Canadian girl for that summer.
The Canadian girl. Was that some sort of a
Well, no, what they did was to offer two scholarships each year to a number of countries, one to a girl and one to a boy, as to come to their, and other people could go if they could pay for it. But they did give out scholarships, and I got the girls' scholarship for that summer.
Well, now, what were they teaching?
International affairs.
Well, what kind of courses did that
involve? History and current affairs, politics. The whole
all over the world, or did you concentrate on
mostly
some aspect?
Mostly European affairs, but with interest in other parts too. But the emphasis was on. I remember one of the lecturers was Sir Norman Angell, who used to be one of my heroes at that time. I'd read some of his books, and he was to be speaking that night, and I came in a minute too late. And here was this gorgeous man on the platform, great tall man with a great head of white hair, just the most distinguished looking man you ever saw in your life. And I thought, I knew Sir Norman Angell would look like that. And to my total dismay, he suddenly sat down, and I realized that he was introducing the funny little man who got up. Sir Norman Angell was a strange, just a very uninteresting, funny little man.
Okay.
In spite of his great brain and all his influence.
Well, were the courses now to take so many months?
It was the same as a summer institute.
Just a summer.
But you would be amazed at the people I have met around the world since, who are very proud of the fact that they went to the summer institute.
Well, now what does it qualify you to do or to be?
It was just more background, that's all, for government positions
in embassies
so or whatever, or government departments, state departments, or equivalent, that kind of thing. But it didn't. All you got was a diploma, you didn't give you a degree, because it was too short a course. But it was a step. I was looking for steps. How does a girl in 1933 or 34 become a diplomat, in Canada? And so, in the meantime, I had had an introduction to Gertrude Riddell, who was the Canadian permanent delegate to the League of Nations. And I had gone around to present my introduction and ask whether there was any possibility of a job. I said, I'll clean floors, I'll do anything to stay here. He said, well, we do have a cleaning woman. He said, I don't know, whipping bug. So I went on with my courses. And he said, come back and see us later in the summer. So I went back to see him later in the summer. And they invited me to a lunch or something one day, just as I was a Canadian in town.
Did their students have to be,
they were all, you were all university graduates. Oh, yes, they were all university graduates. You had to be a graduate student to go there. It was a postgraduate level.
Mm-hmm. But a summer with them was supposed to make it possible for you to do something, to go out.
It was just
background,
presumably amplifying what you already had.
But a degree from there would allow you, would look good on a resume.
It would look good on a resume.
And did it?
Oh, yes.
For you?
It helped, yes, because Dr. Dell was delighted to know that I was doing this. So when I saw him again later in the summer, he said, you know, the Prime Minister is coming for the Assembly and he's not bringing his secretary. Would you like to handle his correspondence? I said, yes, of course. And he said, can you type? I said, oh, yes.
Could you? Okay.
Well, yes. Sort of. I could type better than I could take shorthand, I can tell you.
Shorthand was necessary still.
Yeah. So anyway, the Assembly came along, and I presented myself at the Hotel de la Paix in the suite of the Prime Minister of Canada, and they wanted to send a telegram to me. I said, send a telegram, and I managed to get it down.
Right.
And one of the men, one of his assistants, came out to be sure I had got it down right. So he said, that's all we need today. And so I went and got rid of the telegram. I went down to the opening of the Assembly and sat in the press gallery with a couple of friends I'd already made.
What were you paid
to do that?
Yeah,
they
wage
paid. I was paid. I was paid to do this. And so I went back the next day, and Mr. Bennett was alone then, and he looked at me over his pince-nez and said, had you scared yesterday, didn't I? He turned out to be a sweetheart, and I did. Did quite a few things for him, but it wasn't what you would call backbreaking work.
Well, could you support yourself?
I had enough money left. I still had a little funds left from my grandmother.
You were eating up your grandmother's
time. I was just about down to my last nickel.
Well, were you paid sort of pretty soon? Or were you
I hardly remember. Well, you see, the scholarship paid for board and lodging.
I see.
Tuition, board and lodging. All I had to do was get there.
Mm-hmm.
So for the entire summer, I was taken care of. And then I only had to bridge a few days until I started working at the delegation. And so they took me temporarily onto the payroll at the delegation. And then after the Assembly was over, and one of the things that was lucky about that, after the Assembly was over, I of course asked Dr. Dell whether there was any possibility of my staying on. One of the fortunate things had been that with the Prime Minister was Dr. Skelton, the Undersecretary for External Affairs, so he knew who I was and had seen what I was able to do. And so when Dr. Dell wrote to Ottawa to say that we would like to keep Ms. Greenwood, it was easy. Because Dr. Dell had always retained the right to hire the people who worked with him. You see, again, the external service was terribly, it was just beginning, really. And so Dr. Dell had always said, I wish to choose the girls who worked with me. And you had to be a university graduate. You had to be fluent in French and German also, so much the better. At that time I had some German. And so it was not when people talk about being a secretary these days, they look down their noses with great scorn at anybody who's a secretary.
Yeah.
In those days, I had one of the plum jobs.
Were the friends you made in college, what were they doing?
I completely lost track of most of them. I don't even know to this day what most of them did.
Mm-hmm.
I only saw one or two of them, and most of them just got married.
Yeah. And that was the end of them.
And that was the end of them. So I don't know what became of them.
You went on to do all these interesting things.
I had gone off to see the world. So I worked in Geneva for 6 years during the 30s. Of course, there were enormous interesting experiences. The Abyssinian War and all the trouble in Spain, of course. I went through all that period. And then I was there when World War II began. Dr. Dell had been transferred from Geneva to Washington in about 1937, I think it was 36.
And you
came? I stayed on in Geneva, and Hume Wrong was his successor. And so I was confidential secretary to Hume Wrong when he came. And then when the war started, the delegation, it was 3 men and 3 women. There were 6 of us. It was a small delegation. It was a very pleasant way to place
Sounds
to work.
Like it.
It's very pleasant. And because of the delegation was small, we used to be invited to just all kinds of things.
The other women were secretaries?
Yes, there were 3 of us. I was the senior one.
Mm-hmm.
They were Canadian girls who'd gone through the how should I say, the selection process in Ottawa, and had taken the civil service exam and so on. But we worked very happily together. It was fine. My French was better than theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were no problems that way. Someone could say that I was unqualified, but I wasn't. I had a university degree. I'd had the Zimmern thing, and I had a half shot at a business course.
Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't make a diplomat of you.
It didn't make a diplomat of
you. But it
no,
brought you close.
It brought me into the area, shall
power circle.
It yeah. brought me into yeah. the power circle.
Yeah.
And so when the war began, Hume Wrong went promptly to London, and one of the other men, Alfred Rives, stayed on in the Geneva office, and I stayed on. Everybody else left. There were just the 2 of us to keep things going. And the chief thing they had to do was clear out the Canadians from all over Switzerland and get them out of the country, which was quite an experience in itself. I remember the French put a train at our disposal on a certain day, and I had to get on the telephone and call Canadians all across Switzerland, and you could only talk French or German, and most of the Canadians didn't speak much of either. And it was quite a business rounding people up. But we got people to Geneva and put them all on this train. And the train was sealed. We told them be sure to take a picnic because you won't be allowed to stop between Geneva and the Channel ports. And so off they went. We kind of wondered what would happen to us. But
well, how long did you stay?
I stayed there till February of 1940. And then, about the end of January, somewhere around there, 1940, I had a cable from Washington, from Dirk Riedel, saying that he had just been appointed the first Canadian High Commissioner to Wellington, New Zealand.
Ah.
And would I like to join them in New Zealand?
Oh.
So how to get there? At that time, there was no question of trying to get to London and get across the Atlantic, and then that way, the easiest way, the only way you could sort of book ahead was to go on an Italian ship from Genoa through the Suez.
So they closed this office in
so
Geneva completely?
They didn't close it right away. Dr. Riff stayed on for a while, but they closed it. The League, see, the League finally moved out, I think, sort of May and June, so they had about another 3 months to go. And then when they finally packed up, they had everybody there. The League and all the other embassies and legations and delegations and everybody, they all left. So I went by Italian ship through the Suez to New Zealand, at least to Australia, and I got off the ship in Melbourne because I began to get awfully nervous being on an Italian ship. Because Italy came into the war not too much later.
You were all alone?
Oh, yeah.
You were a very independent family.
Oh, yeah. So I got to Australia, and there, of course, I had a tremendous number of relations on my mother's side. Mother was born in Australia. my grandmother was a Wyndham, which is a very old English family. A great many of them had come out to Australia in the early days and had set up old vineyards and all kinds of things. The history of the Wyndhams is a whole tape in itself. I won't go into that in too much detail. But they're an interesting historic family. They had moved to...
Pardon? That sounds like they were really pioneers, because they were set up as a penal colony, first of all.
Oh, well, they were not penal colonists. The Wyndham who first took the family in that general direction would be my great-great-grandfather in 1827. He was the third son, so he was not going to inherit. He was the one who was scheduled to occupy the church in the village and be the local vicar. And George had no intention of having that kind of life. And so he had gone to Canada with a man by the name of John Galt to see how he liked Canada, and the Canadian winters in 1824 didn't appeal to him too much, so he'd gone home and had gone off to France to learn how to make wine and grow grapes. While he was doing that, he married a beautiful Belgian girl whom he met in Brussels. And so his father realized that George was never going to settle down and be the local vicar. You know, in those days, the families who controlled the village, so to speak, controlled the church, the little village church. And so he could make George be the vicar if he wanted to, but George wanted no part of that. So his father said, "Well, George, here's £3,000, which in those days was a nice sum. Never let me see you again. A remittance man." Mm. George chartered a ship and filled it with the first Hereford cattle that ever went to Australia, and goats and sheep and, you know, livestock, and a couple of his friends and servants and food and clothing and everything you can think of for a pioneer venture into the new world. And they set off from London in August of 1827, and they arrived off Sydney Heads Boxing Day, and went ashore, and George went to a livestock, or at least to a land auction, I should say. There were land auctions in those days, like there were in the beginning days of this country. And bought sight unseen several acres, hundreds of acres of land up in the Hunter Valley, and trekked all that livestock up there. And with the land had been sold by a man who'd received it from the government a few years before that as an effort to encourage settlers. And he hadn't made a go of it, and he was going home and unloading the land. And with the land came 20, penal colony indentured servants, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so George sets these men to work building him a house, and they camped until the house got built. And he founded a dynasty, and the Wyndham Reserve wines are still the best Australian wines. And he is still known in Australian history as a man who introduced Hereford cattle. And there are Wyndhams now scattered up and down the whole west coast of Australia, east coast of Australia, all through New South Wales and everywhere else.
So you stopped in Australia and Melbourne on your way to...
So I stopped in Melbourne, and then went on up just to and then eventually got a ship across to Wellington and installed there. So I helped set up the first Canadian High Commissioner's office in Wellington, New Zealand. And by then I was on the verge of being recognized as a lady diplomat. The New Zealanders accorded me full diplomatic privileges, and they treated me as a diplomat.
You had arrived.
Well, I had arrived for the New Zealanders, but my salary from Ottawa was still just the same.
Meager.
But during the war years, we'd been there about 3 years when the High Commissioner had a heart attack. And so I had to really run the office for a while. And then when he was better, he went home on consultations, and I acted as High Commissioner. I used to sign dispatches as acting High Commissioner. And the New Zealand government were always terribly nice about this, and really very helpful. You know, I was only I wasn't 30 years old, you know.
Oh, is that right?
I was only 28 or 29 when I was doing this.
So you really you got to your goal, rather?
Well, I never really got to it. I just skirted the edges. So when, in August of 1944, when Dr. Dell came back from Ottawa, it was my turn to go home on leave. And I came back across the Pacific on a troop ship, which is a story in itself, and to San Francisco, and then it took 10 days to get a train up to Vancouver, because you couldn't, ship movements, of course, were secret, mm-hmm. especially a troop ship, and so there was no way to book ahead. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I got up to Canada again.
Well, you're back to Vancouver. Let's stop here.
I had been working at External Affairs in the Special Division for about 3 months, and one day we all used to go over to the cafeteria in the Chateau Laurier, which was that famous old hotel in Ottawa, for lunch. And I ran into Ross McLean, who had been the official secretary at Canada House in London in the days when I was in Geneva. And a great reunion, and what was I doing? Well, I'm still trying to be a lady diplomat, Roz. Oh, he said, don't waste your time, come and work with us at the National Film Board. It turned out that he was the deputy film commissioner at that time. So I said, well, I can't just leave External Affairs just like that after working for them for 11 years. Oh, he said, sure you could. Well, anyway, I went in to see the undersecretary of External Affairs. Say, how much longer is it? I was already a member of a group of about half a dozen women who were being groomed for the day when they would recognize women in the professional service. I was being prepared for it. Mm-hmm. I had got that far. And he said, well, it'll probably be another 5 years. And I went home and thought about this, and I went over and had an interview with the film commissioner, John Grierson, who was the famous father of documentary film. He was a Scot whom the government had brought to Canada at the beginning of the war to develop the National Film Board of Canada. And I was hired. And to my amazement, 2 weeks later, I had left External Affairs and was the public relations officer of the National Film Board.
Hmm.
And my beat was the press gallery and government departments and the embassies and so on. And a lot of interesting jobs came along during those years. One of the first interesting, really exciting jobs, I don't know whether you know about the Mulberry docks that were used in the landings in D-Day in Normandy.
No.
How did they get the troops ashore on the French coast on D-Day?
Yeah.
They had these floating docks.
Oh, yeah.
Which had been invented by the British.
Mm-hmm.
And the original model had been seen by the man who at that time was the governor of the Hudson Bay Company and the head of the Engineering Institute of Canada. They said the people of the Dominion should see these and realize what a wonderful thing it was, these mm-hmm. Mulberry docks. So the end was they brought one of them over, they brought the original one to Canada along with a couple of English colonels and a few captains and other people, and this great tour, and I was detailed off to travel across the country and show this to the people of Canada, which was an interesting experience. And other similar jobs, I traveled across the country with the model of the plan that had been devised for the Ottawa of the future, the capital plan, which the maquette for which had been built by the people at the National Film Board. So I traveled across the country with that, and I had a lot of interesting experiences with the National Film Board and got to know Canada better than I ever would have done any other way. And it was during this that I met Red.
I was gonna.
To get to the point what we've been leading up
how
to.
How does a career girl?
How does a career girl suddenly become a faculty wife? The reason I met him was because they were doing Canada in the senior seminar in economics at Mount Holyoke College at that time, where Red was chairman of the economics department.
They were doing Canada?
Canada was the theme of the each second semester in the economics, apparently they took a particular country as an example of all kinds of problems of economic development, everything, the whole thing. this is just one course. They had lots of other courses to learn.
Yeah.
But this was just one course. And so I forget how many seniors there were, 18 or 20 of them. So their visit to Canada was arranged at a very high level, and they had appointments with all our top government officials and all sorts of other people, including Kay Hawkins, or Kay Greenwood, as she was then. And so because I was having a program for them in the evening, I was invited to dinner at our most elegant golf club, where they were being dined and wined beforehand, and I got to sit next to the professor.
Uh-huh.
And his opening gambit was, "Well, tell me about your work." And it just so happened that two nights before, I had been putting on a program for the Prime Minister, not the same one that I had worked for in Geneva all those years before. And I had said my piece and given the high sign to the projectionist to start rolling, and he was making frantic signs at me that the machine wasn't working, and I had to go on ad-libbing, and fortunately it wasn't for too long, and Red said, "That's nothing, you ought to have a row of Chinese generals in the front row who would shoot you if the machine broke down." I thought, this is an interesting man.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we talked about a little bit. He'd already spent quite a bit of time in China at that point. So, but other than thinking that he was a very pleasant man, it was just another evening's work as far as I was concerned. I never thought I'd ever see him again. But about 6 weeks later, I had a letter from the Mount Holyoke Institute on the United Nations, and his signature, inviting me to take part in the Mount Holyoke Institute on the United Nations, which was an affair that went on for about 3 years. Sponsored by the Carnegie Endowment, and all the New England schools were taking part in it. They were trying to educate Americans about the United Nations so that it wouldn't be the same kind of fiasco that happened with the League of Nations, which the Americans never joined.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to avoid anything like that happening a second time. And so this institute, while it was physically at Mount Holyoke, was a very widespread thing, and everybody was anybody in international affairs in those days came and gave a speech at it. I was on the same program with people like Eleanor Roosevelt.
Really?
All sorts of other people.
He wanted you to come and give a...
He wanted me to come down and talk about government information work and show some films and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I took the letter into Ross McLean and said, "Look what I've got. Should I go or should I turn it to our New York office?" "Oh," said Ross, "it's for you personally. They're paying your expenses and they're awfully busy in the New York office. Why don't you go?" So I went.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of the story.
Mm-hmm.
But I almost didn't go, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Red told me afterwards, I almost didn't go to that dinner because I had some people I wanted to see. And the only time to see them would have been to go and have dinner with them. And he said, "Well, after all, I was in charge of the group." He said, "You'd better go to the dinner." So both of us almost didn't go.
So what kind of a courtship did you have? You went somewhere else, basically, and he and...
Well, he was in South Hadley, a very busy man, and I was in Ottawa, a very busy girl, and I had some cousins and also an aunt at that time living in Montreal, and I used to go down and visit them quite regularly, and he would come up for the weekend, because in those days, to get from the Connecticut Valley to Ottawa for the weekend just wasn't possible. There were no plane connections. The train would there and back took the whole weekend, and to drive took overnight, and it was just hopeless.
Was Red a full professor?
Oh, Red was, not only was he full professor, he was chairman of the department.
Mm-hmm. But he was fairly
Oh, Red
young.
Was very senior. No, Red was already well into his 40s.
I see.
Red was 7 years older than I, uh-huh. and he was already into his 40s. Red had been a full professor for several years when I met him.
Had all of his teaching experience been at Holyoke?
Red was at Mount Holyoke. When he came to Wisconsin, he had been at Mount Holyoke for 28 years.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Yeah, but he'd had long leaves of absence, and one of the reasons that Mount Holyoke kept him as long as it did was because they let him go when he felt he needed to.
Yeah.
And of course, during the war, the minute World War II started, he'd gone to Washington with the price control.
Mm-hmm.
And then from price control, they grabbed him to go to China with the Office of War Information.
This was all before you were married.
This was all before I ever heard of him.
What year were you married then?
51. We met in 49. It took us 2 years to get married because we never saw each other.
Mm-hmm.
We had a voluminous correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
But I marveled, after I married Red, I marveled he ever wrote as many letters as he did when he ever found the time to write them. None of them were ever very long, but he used to send them up special delivery.
Well, so you married in B.C.?
Or no, we were married in Montclair at the home of my aunt and uncle, whom I mentioned earlier, the Captain and Mrs. McConkie, because Mother couldn't come east. Mm-hmm. She wasn't well enough at that time. And it was winter, it was February, and his mother didn't want to travel up to Ottawa, and there really wasn't anybody in Ottawa who especially wanted to give me away. And so my aunt's home, which had been my home from home for years, seemed to be the logical place to do it.
But then after you were married, you went back to Holyoke, the two of you. And
after we were married, we didn't go back to Holyoke. After we were married in February, we went up to the Laurentians in Canada for our honeymoon, because I couldn't come back into the country to live. See, I was a Canadian citizen, and so I was marrying an American. In order to come into the country, after I was married, I had to promise to leave the country immediately and then reapply to come in as the wife of an American citizen. So we had to have our honeymoon outside the country,
right,
which is why we went up into the Laurentians, went skiing.
Hmm.
And so we went straight to Washington. Red had taken the second semester off, because he was intending to finish a book he was working on. He wanted to do some research at the Library of Congress and other places. And we got to Washington, and we were just found a place to stay and were getting started when someone spotted him and said, "Red Hawkins is in town, grab him." The Korean War had started and they wanted somebody in price control again.
Well, so you were a wife of a professor, but not in the conventional way, not immediately.
I was the wife of a government official, a temporary one.
Yeah.
And then while we were doing that, I signed up at the Corcoran Art School for a painting course.
But first, you had just had to drop your...
I had to completely finish. At the time that I married Red, I was being considered to be attached to the Canadian Embassy in Paris to handle film distribution for the National Film Board. My combination of external affairs and film board work was suddenly coming together, and I was going to be assigned to Paris, attached to the embassy.
Hmm.
And that's as close as I really got to diplomatic status in the Canadian service.
So in a way, I
almost achieved my ambition, but I got married, and I had to give it all up because it was all Canadian, and there was no way that I could go on working for the Canadians married to an American professor.
So, your life took a big switch.
So my life, I gave up a great deal when I got married.
No,
I had
gave
just
up my country.
I not only gave up my country, but I had just reached the point in what I had been working for all these years.
Yeah.
But it was just about to gel.
Well, how did you feel about that? Did you think about that at the time?
Of course I thought about it. But Red was a persuasive character. I thought he was pretty nice.
Yeah.
You know he was.
You must have had to think that, to give up all that.
So it really wasn't all that difficult. So while we were in Washington, Red was approached to go to Indonesia for the beginning of the aid program, ECA, as it was called.
Wait a minute, you were talking about going to the Corcoran Art
School. Oh, yes, I signed up. Well, while Red was working at price control.
Uh-huh. You were there a year?
We were there about 6 months.
Uh-huh.
And we were just getting ready to go back to Mount Holyoke and set up housekeeping in Mount Holyoke together when Red was asked to go to Indonesia. So he was given 2 years. This was 1951. We'd only been married 6 months, less. I had to become an American citizen in order to go with him, because his job had temporary diplomatic status. And an American diplomat, even a temporary one, can't go abroad if the wife is not a citizen.
So
they called up from the State Department to know whether Mrs. Hawkins was psychologically prepared to become a citizen. I said, "Well, suppose I'm not. Well, then you can't go."
Oh, it's just
it was as simple as that. So I had no trouble whatever in becoming an American citizen. I went through it. There's a clause in the act where the wife of a diplomat or somebody in the armed forces can become a citizen by the quick process, which takes about a week. I had to pass a test, and it just so happened that they were swearing people in at the district court in Washington the following week. I took the oath on Wednesday, got my passport on Thursday, and left the country on Sunday. For Indonesia the first time. And Red was the program planning officer, the economic counselor, briefly the deputy country representative. And there were only about 12 men at the beginning, and they all wore about three or four hats. And it was really the beginning of the aid program. And the man who was the country director, Sam Hayes, was an old friend of Rudd's. His father had been the chairman of the philosophy department at Mount Holyoke, and Sam had been born in South Hadley, and he and Red had known each other for a long time. But anyway, so off we went to Indonesia, around by way of Europe. We went for 2 years, but in the end we were only there 1 year, because at the end of the first year, they brought Red back to Washington to be the desk officer, the Indonesia desk officer, in the aid headquarters.
His field was international.
Economics. And he was heading, he had been labor economics, but because of all this, he was getting more very much interested in development economics, yeah, which became a whole new thing after the war. But he was very much interested in labor economics in Indonesia. And did a lot of work on their trade unions and things like that. So at the end of a year in Washington, we finally reported for work in South Hadley at Mount Holyoke.
Mm-hmm.
And it must have been 1954, I guess. I became a full-blown faculty wife with nothing to do but be a faculty wife. Except that after about a year, I discovered that a faculty wife could do graduate work for free.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was too tempting to my Scottish soul, and so I saw out that I wanted to take a master's degree, and so I decided, well, French is what I knew best. And modern French literature seems indicated, and I had a perfectly lovely time reading French novels instead of doing the breakfast dishes for the next 2 years.
Well, how big was the department then?
The economics department?
Uh-huh.
There were six of them.
Well, and what did they make of you?
Economics and sociology. Well, I didn't teach in the economics department. I taught in the French department.
No, I say, what did they make of you?
What did they think of me?
Yeah, coming in. Were they?
They were very welcoming. They welcomed me with open arms. They couldn't have been nicer.
What did they do with their lives at that time? You were interested in going on, but what were they doing?
The two senior people in the department were Red and a man by the name of John Lobb, who died just the other day. His wife was a first-class cellist, and she took part in all kinds of musical things, and she taught music at the college. And let me see who else was there. Then two of the women professors, terribly distinguished women economists, Amy Hughes and Peg Comstock, of course, we're not married, but very wonderful women. Mm-hmm. You know, a place like Mount Holyoke in those days had some wonderful women on the faculty, just outstanding people. Red was honored to work with them. You know, people like, what's her name, E.B., that caliber of people, just absolutely outstanding. And then who else was there at that time in the beginning? I can hardly remember.
It had to be different than coming into the Madison situation.
Totally different. The Madison situation was just totally different.
Well, you were a faculty wife.
You see, at a place like Mount Holyoke, you know the whole faculty. You don't just know your colleagues in your department.
Yeah.
You know the entire faculty, because the entire faculty at Mount Holyoke in those days was about 200.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were only 1,800 students. And so it's, it, in a way, it's more interesting because you know people in all sorts of disciplines.
Mm-hmm. Were there things expected of you as the wife of a senior economics professor within the university committee or community or the college community or
well, you
community
took, you
at
took,
large?
Oh yes, you took part in all kinds of things.
Because you were expected to, because you sought it out and wanted to.
Just sort of happened. I mean, everybody did things. Mm-hmm. Everybody just did things. The wives were all people who'd had, they were all university women themselves. I don't know any who weren't.
Is that right?
I think all of them were university people. There might have been a few who weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then you see, there weren't such an awful lot of men on the faculty. The greater part of the faculty at Mount Holyoke was women, and very distinguished women. So that there weren't that many faculty wives. You were one of a rather small group of people.
Mm-hmm. That's very elite.
So that you sort of set the standard yourself in a way for what you were going to do. And because, like Nancy Lobb, who was with her cello, well, for instance, one very close friend is still a close friend, Roger and Louise Holmes. Louise is a Chicago girl originally. Her husband was chairman of the philosophy department. He was the son of Haynes Holmes. I can't think of his first name, but a very famous preacher in New York way back. He was the rector, whatever you call it, of one of the big churches in New York. I can't remember. This is gone and gone now. I'll know when I think of it. But anyway, Louise, as a graduate of the Art Institute of Chicago, enormously interested in Oriental art and all kinds of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
These were the kind of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, you.
So there was no sort of feeling of. That you were just being a wife.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that you were just being a housewife.
Mm-hmm.
There and also there was a tremendous amount of entertaining, not just for the sake of having a party, but because there was an endless stream of visiting speakers coming onto the campus all the time. At a place like Mount Holyoke, people are brought in from the outside in droves to specialists and everything you can name
to
talk to the girls. So we had to pitch in and help entertain all these people. Of course, we took turns,
mm-hmm.
and you entertained the people in your department, but you invited everybody else, and some came and some didn't. And
you
some,
enjoyed that?
It was great fun, and it was enormously interesting.
Yeah.
A great stream of enormously interesting people went through our living room, week after week.
Well, you had given up a career goal, really, and a citizenship. Canadian citizenship to marry this man, but you apparently also felt you had some pluses going for you because you were the wife of a professor. You could go back to school for free.
I could go back to school for free, and I was continuing to meet interesting people. One of the things I had enjoyed about my former life was that I was meeting interesting people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was continuing to meet interesting people. I had traveled already quite considerably before I met my husband, but because of our involvement with Indonesia, we continued to travel quite extensively.
Mm-hmm.
So that in that sense, I hadn't really given up anything. I had gained quite a lot in some ways.
Mm-hmm. You have a trade-off.
I had a real trade-off.
Yeah.
It was a real trade-off.
But now it was while you were still at Holyoke that you went on out to Indonesia.
We went to Indonesia several times. We went the first time in 51.
From Washington. Though.
From Washington, but Red was on leave from Holyoke.
Mm-hmm.
We never thought of it as going from Washington.
I
we thought of it as going from Holyoke.
Yeah.
Because we'd been back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
It was as if I hadn't set foot at South Hadley. I'd been there several times with them. Everybody knew me already.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd been entertained by everybody before we ever went off to Indonesia that first time. I got my master's degree in 57, and taught for a year in the French department, which was fun. Mm-hmm. And then the following year we went off to Indonesia again. This was where we were asked to join the Wisconsin team the first time.
In 58. Was that the Gajimata?
That was the Gajimata project. Mm-hmm. And that happened because Red had been back there in the summer of 56 mm-hmm. doing some research on the batik industry with a grant from MIT or Harvard. Harvard, I think. I forget. It was MIT or Harvard, one or the other. Mm-hmm. And he had known the Dean Kurt Nagoro, who was the dean of the beginning of the economics faculty at Gajimata. So that when Ed Young and Reed Tripp went out to set up the affiliation from Wisconsin, and it was realized they would have to engage economists from other schools to fill out the team, mm-hmm. Dean Kurt Nagoro asked Ed if he knew Professor Hawkins at Mount Holyoke College.
Well, that's how it came.
And Ed allowed he'd never heard of Professor Hawkins at Mount Holyoke College. Mm-hmm. But he hadn't been home very long when he was knocking on our doorstep in South Hadley to ask us to join the Wisconsin team.
What was it felt there weren't enough professors?
There weren't enough. You know, they wanted eight professors.
Oh, they wanted eight.
And to take eight people from the department here would have been quite a, wouldn't have been possible.
No.
It wouldn't have been possible. So they got Red and they got somebody from down south. I can't think of his name. Two people from down south, actually.
Reed was there, Reed Tripp.
Reed Tripp was head of the project in the beginning.
Was.
He was the first head.
Yeah.
And Ted Morgan took over from Reed when Reed and Mary came back.
And then Red?
Red was never head of the Wisconsin project out there, though he couldn't be, you see. He was not Wisconsin faculty then.
But he was there at the same time?
Well, we joined the Wisconsin team.
But you weren't all there together at the same time?
Yes.
Oh, you were?
Yes. No. When we first went there, the Tripps were still there.
I see.
And Red worked with Reed for several months, and then the Tripps left, and the Morgans arrived while we were still there.
Uh-huh.
And we were there for a year and a half, and during that time, so we had almost a year with the Morgans in Georgia.
And he was training.
Well, they were teaching in the economics faculty. While the men who were going to be the professors eventually were abroad getting their advanced degrees.
Over here, yeah.
You see, that's why they had to have an active teaching team, because they were to be the teachers
mm-hmm.
While the Indonesians were getting trained.
And those Indonesians didn't necessarily come just to Wisconsin.
No, they went all over.
They went all over.
And so then, we came home in January of 60 mm-hmm. and went back to South Hadley. We had no thought of leaving Mount Holyoke. We went back to South Hadley and we continued on at Mount Holyoke. But Ed had apparently decided at that time that he really wanted to get Red here permanently. But it took quite a while because I think the department didn't particularly want somebody as old as Red.
Oh, what year in fact did he?
After some correspondence backwards and forwards, and I think Red came up once for a visit, it was decided the thing to do would be to bring us here for a semester visiting, and Red could decide whether he wanted to come, and the economics department could look him over and decide whether they wanted to have him, because
mm-hmm.
I gather there were people who said, well, he's too old. You know, people like to hire, he's too expensive. Red was not only the chairman of the economics department, he was a Mary Lyon scholar,
mm-hmm.
which is one of these special chairs that you have here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't too keen to get somebody as expensive as Red. They wanted somebody cheaper and younger.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way a department chairman thinks, you know. They all do it. No criticism, they all do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't anything against Red personally.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, the way things are. So then we came out here in the spring of 63, and it was arranged that we stayed in Santo Singale's house. You remember over there on Winona Way, and looking out, and I had Santo's studio to paint in, looking out on the skyline of Madison, and Red didn't have to be on any committees, and he thought, isn't this lovely?
How did you arrange that?
Before we came, Red had already agreed to go back to Indonesia for the Harvard Development Advisory Service to help Indonesia get its economic research institute going. And we were committed to doing that. And Ed said, oh, that's all right. You're all going to Indonesia and Harvard pays the bill instead of us. That's fine. Go ahead.
But you hadn't decided, he hadn't decided to come to the university at that point. That was just why you were there for that 6 months period.
No, we came for that 6 months knowing that we were being looked over and that we were supposed to make our minds up by spring.
And the department was to make its mind up.
Everybody was to make up their minds during that spring semester of 63.
What did you do those 6 months?
I painted.
You painted?
I painted.
Did you join a group or did you?
No, Kathy Morgan, because we knew the Morgans already, you see. Kathy took me down to sign up for a painting course. And I signed up for a course with Warrington Colescott. I think I was the last painting student he ever had. He called me a few days later and wanted to know about me, and I told him, who I were and where we lived. He said, you know, you're the only person who signed up for my course, and I was wondering what to do.
Was this at the university?
This was at the university, Warrington Colescott, in the art department.
He was giving...
He was moving over to being a printmaker and teaching printing, but he had taught painting earlier on.
And you could, as a faculty wife...
I could sign up to take a course.
I don't think it's that easy anymore.
It isn't anymore, but back in 63 it was still possible. So I signed up, and he called me. And when he discovered that we lived on Winona Way, he still lived there himself with his first wife, remember? He is still married to Ellen, the dancer. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll stop by every Friday night on the way home and give you an hour's critique. And he did. He was wonderful. He never missed.
Well,
or if he missed once because of a department meeting or something, he came another night.
Sounds to me, we've left over all that about your painting and stuff. The last we talked about that was when you were briefly in Washington and you went to the Corcoran. Was that your first sort of...
Oh, no. I had studied art on and off all my life. And I had, in between strenuous times, I had always been interested in painting.
Did you have some sort of aspirations in that regard as far as...
I always wanted to paint. But I knew I could never earn my living that way. I wanted to be a diplomat, but I was always interested in painting, ever since I was a small child. And the first painting that I painted at Mount Holyoke that I thought was any good, I sent to Otto as a tribute to his having encouraged me way back when he first married my mother. He still has it. It's a nice painting. I like it. But anyway...
Did Red encourage you to do this?
Oh yes, Red encouraged me a lot. He was just delighted to have me paint. When I the first show I had in South Hadley, he came home after class one afternoon to find the living room full of people waving checkbooks. He was absolutely overcome.
What kind of husband was Red? Was he helpful around the house?
He was very
and
helpful. He said he was strictly unskilled labor. He loved chopping wood and fixing things and climbing on the roof and chopping off the ice and doing all those great manual outside things that I certainly wouldn't enjoy doing. He was very good at planning things and choosing things, helping to choose furniture and rugs. When we found a house in South Hadley, we had to furnish it. I discovered he had interesting and excellent taste in ideas for furnishing things. He had studied architecture. Well, you know, he went to Oberlin for his undergraduate work. And he had taken some art courses and art history courses at Oberlin. And you know, he was interested in artistic things. His mother had been an architect. And so he had an interest there that he'd grown up with right along.
So he did share that kind
so
of
we
artistic
shared that.
Quality.
Oh, yes, life. Very much so.
Your life in some ways is got to be different. You were both career people, but you didn't have the family.
We didn't have any children. So I was able to really work at my painting.
Yes. And he didn't have to pitch in and do the kinds of things for you or for the family that
He didn't have to help babysit or do the chores or take the kids to whatever. He didn't have any of those responsibilities at all. We were at a later stage in life. You see, I was 37 when we were finally married. And so it was a.
You really never thought about having children.
Well, if it had happened, it would have been all right, but it didn't.
But in those days too, at that age, we didn't think about having children. Nowadays, you can have your amniocentesis to make sure the baby's all right if you're going to have a late baby, and now it's not considered.
No, we didn't consider having a baby.
Wasn't because you didn't like children, or
somehow didn't enter into things. Red was much too busy, and I guess I was much too busy.
Yeah,
I was much too busy. And of course, our lives were so much involved with Indonesia and Indonesian things, and we were enormously interested in that. And I was painting Indonesian scenes and Indonesian all kinds of Indonesian memories. My paintings in those days, I mean, the whole Indonesia thing has pretty well worked itself out by the time we came to live in Madison. But in that early period, I think I was very much influenced by Indonesian art and Indonesians and the whole Indonesian scene. And I worked with oils with palette knives in those days, and I really did a lot of Indonesian themes, most of which have been sold long since. Most of them never came to Madison. They were gone long before. I used to show around South Hadley. I had some shows there. I had a couple of shows in Indonesia at different times.
I'm remembering, in fact, you were parents of Tony.
Oh, well, that was the nearest thing we came to it, of course. Yes.
Yeah. Tell a little bit about Tony.
Tony, of course, that's an American name. His real name is Antonius Kawocho, the most charming and turning out to be a very bright Indonesian boy. We had known him since he was a small baby, practically. His father was the principal of the Technical Teachers Training College in Yogyakarta. And one of the early projects that Red and I were involved in back in 51, early 52, was getting an English language institute going in Indonesia, in Yogyakarta, which is in central Java. And Tony's father had helped us set up our equipment. And then every time we went to Indonesia, to Yogyakarta after that, of course, Tony's father always came to see us. And they had these four little boys. We were sort of aware of these four little boys. We didn't pay much attention to them. But after the end of the Sukarno regime, after the bloodbath in 1966, Kawocho wrote to us. He'd finished high school by then, to ask whether we knew of any way that he might get a scholarship to get out of there. He'd seen a couple of generals murdered in his backyard kind of thing. And this was a sensitive kid who said, how can I get out of here and get an education? And we knew there was no way we could get him a scholarship. I remember Red came home from the campus one night. Tony's letter had come in a few days before, and he said, let's have a drink and see what we can do about this. So we sat down and talked about it and realized the first thing we had to do was find out what his record was and could he speak any English. So we investigated all this and found that his high school record was very good, and on paper he'd had 6 years of teaching with training in English. And so after some backing and filling, we got him over here. And one thing sort of led to another. When he first came over, he thought he wanted to learn about auto mechanics. And we enrolled him while he was doing an intensive course in English at MATC in their auto mechanics course. And it so happens that the director of the Dunwoodie Institute in Minneapolis, a man by the name of Warren Phillips, and the man who at that time was the chancellor of Stout State, University of Wisconsin campus, had spent 2 years together in Bandung on a Ford Foundation project a few years before, helping Indonesia to upgrade its technical training schools. And they had also known Tony's father. So they were much interested in our bringing the kid over, and so we took Kawocho. Well, we called him Tony pretty soon. You know, his first name was Antonius.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've told you this story in the past. He'd been with us about a week, and I said to him one night at dinner, Cavalcho, your name would be difficult for American students. What would you think if while you're here, just while you're here, we called you Tony from Antonius? And there was a long silence, and I thought I'd put my foot in it irrevocably. And he turned to me with one of the nicest smiles he's ever given me and said, I think I would like it.
I can just see him.
He's still Tony Cavalcho, and he will always be Tony Cavalcho.
Yeah.
But anyway, after Christmas, we enrolled him at the Dunwoody Institute to go on with his career in auto mechanics. But during that time, Warren began to realize that this was a bright kid. And Bud Michaels, the chancellor at Stout, got interested in him and said, well, why don't we try him in the summer student program and see how he does? And he did very well. And so then we enrolled him at Stout for the full program in industrial technology. And of course, as you know, he went through and graduated very well, came back eventually and completed a master's degree in industrial mm-hmm. technology.
Mm-hmm.
And is now back in Indonesia. He's the plant manager. He worked with the Ford Foundation, Ford Motor people, for 2 or 3 years. And then when the whole, after the oil crisis in the Middle East, this affected Indonesia, and Tony began to get worried about the whole future of the whole automobile thing in his country, and he had a chance to go over to Johnson & Johnson pharmaceutical people as their plant manager, and so he decided to do that. So he has moved out of the automobile world. His current ambition is to get a master's degree in business management from Harvard, you know, the Harvard Business School, but they have this special program. I can't think of the name of it. Anyway, in you know, real business management,
yeah.
this is what he wants to do. So this is Tony. He now has a wife and 2 children and is well on the way.
He's going to do that.
I am a total failure as a grandmother, however.
Are you? Let's save that for another time, Kay. Let's save that.
Have we reached the end of the day?
Yeah.